Hello and welcome to So Now What with Gates Cambridge, a podcast tackling some of the world's wicked problems with those who are dedicated to doing something about them. I'm Catherine Galloway and my guests, as always, are Gates Cambridge scholars working to make an impact in the lives of others. It's now officially spring here in the Northern Hemisphere, but so far it feels a soggy and uneasy one. 2023 was the warmest year in recorded history. The past 9 years have been the nine hottest on record, and this year is likely to beat all of those records again. Intolerable weather of all kinds is now a reliable reality for millions of people worldwide. But what does extreme weather really mean for us? Are we just talking survival, or can we do better than that? Joining me on Zoom today, I'm delighted to welcome two members of the Gates Cambridge class of 2014, Song Chao Yao, joining us from Southwest China, and Victoria Herman, speaking from Washington in the United States. Also on Zoom, but only a mile or so away from me in Cambridge, Ramit Debnath, who first arrived here on a Gates scholarship in 2018. Thank you all very much for joining me.
Lovely to be here.
Well, thank you all very much as well for making your international time zones align to talk to me about this most borderless of wicked problems, the climate. Song Chao, in 2016, you were part of the largest ever all-female expedition to Antarctica on board a boat called The Leadership with a crew of 76 women scientists, an experience that led you to found your environmental organisation Wildbound, convinced that if young people connected with nature and their own power as activists, we could begin to turn the tide on our ecological challenges. Victoria, you're a National Geographic explorer with deep experience of the opposite end of the world, the Arctic, and until recently you were president and managing director of the Arctic Institute and have been named as one of the 100 most influential people in climate policy worldwide. And Ramit, you were awarded the first ever Cambridge Zero Fellowship here at the university. You believe a combination of data and design is our smartest route towards understanding what is stopping us taking large-scale action on climate change. And that work has taken you everywhere, from heat mapping the high-rise slums of Mumbai to researching how the local councils of the UK can use responsible AI for their environmental decision-making. Now, the three of you grew up in China, the US, and India, respectively, which, as it happens, are also the world's top three carbon polluters. We'll get into how that backdrop has fueled your climate work later in the programme. But first, I'd love you to tell me the one thing that you're bringing to the table today that's going to help us get started on this topic. Let's start with you, Song Chao.
Sure. Thank you, Catherine. So lovely to be here with Victoria and Ramit. I'm bringing today the sense of deep time and a spring renewal. So I just came back to Dali, to a village in Intel in Southwest China. And it's really obvious spring has come back. And, you know, all the birds and the insects are awakened and animals coming back from winter hibernation. And myself, I was just at a retreat in Bali organized by Christiana Figueres with the Plum Village Monastics. And that is for climate activists to actually look inwards and build inner resilience. So I felt like, you know, I've come out to that retreat and come back to a place where spring is very obvious in the air. And I'm kind of looking forward to how this year unfolds.
So you're bringing resilience and rejuvenation, Song Chao. That's a wonderful start for this podcast. What about you, Victoria?
I don't want to bring us down after Song Chao brought us up with resilience and renewal. But on my mind is the number 28. For Americans, that is 28 distinct extreme weather events in 2023 that caused $1 billion of damage or more. And for me, that number is important because $1 billion is not just a number. That is people's homes. It is people's livelihoods. It is historic downtowns. It is the place that you learn to ride a bike. It's where your parents met. 28 distinct extreme weather events that caused catastrophic devastation in people's lives in every corner of the United States and U.S. territories. climate change is not some distant disaster. It's not in decades. It is in days. It is here, no matter where you live.
Thank you for putting that in such a human, such a local context for us, Victoria. And indeed, it's wildfires, it's floods, it's a national emergency is being declared, you know, almost weekly now. And yet still the dial isn't quite shifting towards mass action. And we'll get into that just a little bit later. But for you, Rami, what are you bringing to the table today?
I care deeply about how do we bring people and their voices back in climate action. And so how do we leverage large-scale public opinion? How do we leverage what they want to do? How to build resilience through it? And what shapes consensus for climate action, which is not also in a case that it, I mean, stops their daily life or kind of disrupts suddenly. So again, these whole elements of social tipping and how to prevent these social tipping elements.
So a big question then, but my setting the scene question for you really is, you've all been in extreme weather environments multiple times, heat, cold, and everything in between. And can you tell me one thing that I'd be surprised to know about that experience? You know, we're hearing a lot and we're seeing a lot on our news, but what does it feel like and what don't we know? What aren't we being told about these moments?
During my PhD in Gates, Cambridge, with the lockdowns from COVID, I faced a huge tropical storm when I was back at home in Calcutta. And then this storm was something that no one expected. So it was called the storm Alia or Alaya. I never felt the power of nature in a way directly, because I always lived in cities and you won't expect the forces of wind actually devastating everything that it's there on its path. Like, and the next challenge that I saw is exactly the resilience and adaptation element, because there the trees fell right on road. And then the bigger question was, whose governance duty it is to clean? Because, yeah, I mean, people are used to do local level work and they had the resources at that scale. But then this becomes a big governance issue, that whom do we call in? And that's why at that time, the National Defense, Disaster Relief Council was called in, because they are the kind of the highest order of response units. But I mean, again, this gives a reflection on how adaptable we are and where are, like, we need to think a lot more about in more extreme climate scenarios.
Victoria, what about you?
When we think of climate disasters and extreme weather events, we often have visuals of devastation of physical things, of bridges, of schools, of homes like the one I'm in. And all of that is true. But for me, the surprising thing is often the most devastating losses of a disaster are the things you can't see. It mm-hmm. is traditions that can't be passed from one generation to the next because the land has been uprooted. It is the loss of a historic building, not just a building someone lived in, but centuries of stories that are now lost. Climate change and extreme weather events hold the potential to take away what makes us who we are as humans. And that intangible heritage, those cultures, that identity, you can't see in photos, it's hard, but it's there in every disaster on every continent. And I would love to hear from both Ramit and Songchao, because, you know, I, especially Songchao, I know that you work with indigenous knowledge and traditions and cultures about, you know, that feeling of what happens when, because of human-made climate change, it challenges centuries, sometimes millennia, of resilient traditions that are passed down.
Is that what you would pick up on, Song Chao, that feeling of being in a climate disaster and it's not necessarily the material damage?
Yeah, absolutely. And I definitely echo with what Victoria has said, because so much of what is lost is invisible. And I also think that so much of what has caused extreme weather is also, in a way, not so visible. There is actually this Taoist ancient story. There's a village experiencing drought and there's no water, and the villagers don't know what to do, and they called for help for a Taoist master. And the master asked for a hut to sit in silence and not to be disturbed. And, you know, the master sat for multiple days, and then all of a sudden the water came back, rain came back. And then people asked him what happened. And he said, you know, when he first sat down, the Tao was not in balance, like things are not in balance. And he had to work to actually balance the qi and the Tao. And when he finally felt in balance, that's when the water came back. It's a bit of an abstract story. And I think my point here is that extreme weather is not new. You know, traditionally we've had experienced droughts, we have experienced disasters, but now it is at a frequency that's very, that's so frequent that it is difficult to actually adapt and to, in a sense, find the balance again. And the second piece there is that some of the traditions and some of the understanding of how land, how weather works. And, you know, for a moment, I guess for the past century or so, for industrialization, we have taken the weather for granted. You know, we thought that the climate would just keep on being temperate and suitable for human development. But now it's actually these reminders of extreme weather that tells us that, no, you know, we cannot take the weather for granted. These are the multiple alarms and signals that sent to us that our way of living, our way of economic development and social development is not in balance. So, yeah, I guess that's what I've been also grasping with since China had extreme cold waves and heat waves in the past year. And my apartment in Beijing had molds on my wall during the summer because it was just raining nonstop, and multiple disasters, floods throughout the country also. So yeah, it is very apparent, and it's a felt experience for all of us right now. And it's a conversation and topic that we can no longer avoid talking about.
That's clear. And yet when I've been thinking about how you're all working and in the sectors that you're all working at, you know, it's so difficult because you're all based in or from absolute super tankers of countries that seem to be steaming inexorably one way. And it's incredibly difficult to get that to turn around. So just as a kind of quick fire round, what are the most impactful ways you have found nationally in your own home countries to prove the urgency of collective action and collective intelligence on this?
One of a very recent example is last year we did a research on heat wave impacts in India, and specifically this lethal heat wave element. And we were surprised because what we did was nothing new, I mean, in terms of understanding the impact, but rather we showed a number that 90% of the country is at risk from, or at danger risk from these heat waves. And that created a very strong political kind of a wave, because that's what the main message that has been missing. And close to 300 national and international media covered that news. And that effect not only just was restricted to that media element, but also it reached World Economic Forum. We were called at G20, which was actually happening in India, to actually chat on and give some ideas about this policy impact that might have. And the main lesson we had was, don't forget heat waves, because in current policy design, heat waves are very new. And so the impacts are also not quite well understood at a very grounded scale. And then Time magazine covered it as that women are most vulnerable because they are the ones who bear the most burden, both time burden, work burden, and also they stay a lot indoors. And these houses in India, especially in low-income communities, are not designed to withstand high heat or lethal heat waves. So there is a huge kind of system awareness or system shift that we have seen with that just one number, that is 90%. And I think that's still going on.
So that's a data-driven proof approach that nobody can essentially argue with those numbers. That's really interesting. And Victoria, I know that for you, if Ramit is proof, then you are truth. You're bringing forward in what you do the ideas of the community knowledge that is being lost in these marginalized coastal communities that actually are already living with extreme weather, but they're not being invited into a conversation or being invited to offer any solutions. So what effect does it have when those voices are heard?
If everyone who is impacted by climate change has a seat at the table in some capacity, it could be a community leader, it could be a youth leader, it could be a coalition that is built across many different communities with the same vision of the future. If everyone has a seat at the table, then we get transformative change. We get the future where we as humans get to thrive and our planet gets to thrive. We are absolutely not there yet. Not everyone has a seat at the table. In fact, almost no one has a seat at the table right now. But things are changing in the U.S. and U.S. territories. Having a current administration that acknowledges climate change is a catastrophic problem and believes in more inclusive decision making than any administration in the past is a big deal for Americans. It provides us a foundation upon which we can build a future that is transformative. We might not be there in 2024, but this gives us the springboard to be there in 10 years, in 20 years. Do we have 10 years or 20 years? We don't. We don't, because climate change and its consequences are moving faster than any of us thought. Right? Our models from 10 years ago weren't as quick as we are experiencing now of extreme heat, of the amount of seasonal changes we are experiencing. For America's northernmost communities in Alaska, in the North American Arctic, it is life-changing and life-threatening disasters that are happening today in 2024 that were projected for 2054. So we don't have that time. But what we do have is tens of thousands of people across the country that are deeply committed to climate action. And there is a coalition that is being built across communities, across generations, and across borders to make that vision for a habitable planet for us and our children a reality, which right now it's just a big question mark.
Thank you. I mean, Ramit, I know you talk about collective intelligence, and here, Victoria, you're touching on sort of the importance of collective responsibility and community sharing. Sonchow, if I bring you in with this focus you have on youth, as you know, it's very impactful to empower the next generation to engage with nature and also to recognize their own power already as activists, as with their ability to do something about it, and instead of just feeling absolutely shocked by the world that they're growing up in. But I know that during the pandemic, your Wild Bound expedition sort of had to change focus a little bit. At the beginning, it was about getting principally Chinese children off their screens and into big nature for big experiences. You needed to rethink during the pandemic and realize that grassroots, even backyard activism, could also be powerful and impactful. Can you tell me a little bit about how that's working now?
Yeah, I think when I started Wildbound in 2017, the world is in a very different place. I was just coming back from the UK and Brexit has just happened. And I felt like for Chinese youth, there needs to be a bit of a waking up to what does this connection with nature mean. And a lot of people are not aware of climate change impacts as much as now. So COVID has both stopped us from our, you know, outward expeditions to further away places, but at the same time, I think has really raised this topic about, you know, because the pandemic started in China, and actually it raised a lot of discussion about our contact with wildlife and with habitats, natural habitats of wildlife, and actually a lot of people through these 3 years of COVID have recognized how important nature is and how precious it is to be outdoors and to breathe fresh air and to have, you know, good produce for food, because all of those, when it's taken away, we actually recognize how important and precious nature is. And what Victoria mentioned about this community, everyone being having a seat at the table and talking about a potentially sustainable future, I think what we're lacking right now is a collective imagination of a better, a prosperous and a regenerative future. Because of the extreme weather events we're going through, we are at a very crucial time, and young people can easily feel that, you know, they're facing a future that's uncertain, that's going to be having more climate disasters, maybe inequality is going to worsen, maybe there's more peace is going to be disrupted. I mean, it's already disrupted in many parts of the world. So I think it's very easy for young people to actually have this sense of pessimism towards the future, and in a sense, a passiveness towards what they're going to actually create. And right now, if you look at the world compared to 7 years ago, I think my role is no longer just empower Chinese youth to actually be connected to nature, but actually empowering youth from different countries. And now our work is also expanding to activists, leaders in the climate and nature field to actually connect and talk to each other and build and strengthen these social fabrics and these relationships and the tissues for resilience when we are experiencing and facing these poly crises. So, you know, I think you can see in the West, and a lot of people, young people are on the street and they're protesting and they're deeply dissatisfied with the current status quo. And in China, it is another extreme that young people are more passive, and they're actually, they don't know where to start and how to actually get involved. But I see that both are different symptoms of the same root cause, is that how can we actually empower young people to imagine a future where they can thrive and they can build society and structures and systems and relationships and support for their individual and the systems thriving. So in our work, we have really emphasized this area of inner well-being, the inner sustainability, as well as the outward action. So this connects to the retreat I was mentioning at the beginning. So the ability to actually tap into some of our ancestral wisdom, to tap into our collective intelligence, to really build deep relationship with other people, and to reflect from what approach, from which inner space am I actually approaching the work of activism? How am I actually creating a new imagination? And what am I bringing to the table when I am in part of a movement, of a conversation, of an activist moment, etc.? So that's kind of where I've been exploring these issues. And I feel like, you know, every year there's new challenges, and I keep trying to find new ways and also seeking wisdom from both nature, from our ancestors, and also from these future generations.
I'm so interested you said that, Songqiao, because just yesterday in preparing for this podcast, I came across the idea of inner development goals for the first time. And that goes alongside the sustainable development goals, but it's the idea of building climate resilience in a way to extreme weather and other threats from within. And I thought that was a really interesting way of approaching the problem. Like, it starts with us before we even go out as actors in the world. And it feels like you're bringing that into your work too, Victoria, with the sort of, with your work as the director of the Preserving Legacies, Giving a Future to Our Past project, which I know is an innovation to collect that wisdom before we lose it forever, and to actually tap into that wisdom to help us resolve the now. The other problem, of course, and Ramit, I know this is something you're very engaged with, is misinformation and polarization in the debate on climate. You know, and if we're talking about young people, you know, they are on their phones, they're getting an enormous amount of social media and various other things thrown at them, not always clear what's true and what isn't. Can you tell me how you're tackling that in your work with responsible AI?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's one of the bigger challenges that we face. And more specifically, when people deny the fact there is climate change or the urgency is not that urgent. So one way that we are trying to deal with this is leveraging large language models, because these are very interesting. I mean, again, they have their own demerits because it's not tested enough. And that's where the whole context of responsible AI becomes very interesting. First, to understand what they are giving out and by it's the tools, AI tools, are they explainable, interpretable, and how trustworthy they are. So that's one first point. And one way to test that is actually kind of look at the entire spectrum of conversations, large scale interactions on these topics, as well as then trying to validate those using more deep knowledge from social sciences, qualitative interviews, and as well as talking to people who have been leading efforts for many years. So, I mean, misinformation is not new. It has been always there in both political and different contexts. So there are deep experts who know the context very well. And for example, I work a lot with experts in Caltech who talk a lot about US-American politics and how they have been managing to tackle some of the misinformation. I mean, responsible AI is not just one single entity, but also the whole alignment with partners and partnerships, building large-scale partnerships with people who have deep knowledge around these fields. So I think that's our first attempt to even try to understand what we can do with these tools.
Thank you, Ramit. And I know you need that data, Victoria, in order to make an impact in the policy field. You need to have the proof. And on this podcast before, in other episodes, we've talked quite a lot about how not to let a good crisis go to waste. Where's the innovation for you in the policy space where people are taking the crisis of extreme weather and using the data that's gathered, using the energy, and actually transforming that into something quite new that we haven't seen that will have a global, a wider impact?
In policy with the climate crisis, I see three distinct innovations. The first innovation, taking capacity building sincerely and equipping people to be empowered to understand and respond to the climate crisis. In past policy, the public generally was perceived as receiving climate disasters, living through them, having no agency of how to build their own resilience, their own climate literacy, and imagine a vibrant future from Sun Chao's point of widening their imagination by equipping them with an understanding of future scenarios and enabling them with the training and the opportunity to start building that future before a disaster hits. We've seen a change in the US and US territories of taking climate literacy seriously and spending money and technical assistance on enabling people to understand climate change. And we have seen a change in empowering and uplifting communities to vision their own futures rather than a top-down approach, have a bottom-up approach with national support. And that's the second innovation, that not everything should be solved by national policy. Most things should be solved by local visions for the future. You understand your community, your village, your city best. And that means that if provided with the resources and the chance to adapt to climate change, to document loss and damage, to co-create sustainable systems that lower greenhouse gas emissions while simultaneously regenerate the ecosystems that we live on. People will take that chance if given it. And we're starting to see that shift from top down to bottom up climate action. And the third and final innovation that I have seen is providing a platform for people to share their stories, that data is more than numbers. Data is also experiences. And for a long time in weather and climate data in the United States, our data sets and the communication from the national government was very numbers driven, like the number that I gave at the beginning of this podcast, 28 $1 billion disasters. But numbers are only meaningful if you connect them to something that you know, something that is in your life. And we are starting to see a change in how we talk about numbers in policy, how we justify costs, how we think about building inclusive frameworks for climate mitigation and adaptation, and building inclusivity, yes, on numbers, but also on stories, on community stories, on individual stories that give a more granular texture than just data number collection can give you. And that last one is really important because we all experience climate change differently, and that will continue to be true in the decades and centuries to come. The more stories that we have of how people experience weather-related disasters, how people are building resilience and adaptation, means that we have more of a diverse foundation to build the systems we need to serve everyone. Across all communities, all abilities, all geographies. You only get that when you weave together this tapestry of hundreds of millions of stories in a country.
Thank you, Victoria. You know, one of the greatest environmental storytellers I have ever had the privilege to talk to was Wangari Maathai from Kenya, who, of course, won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2004. And I interviewed her, and today on this post-it, I had written down to keep her words with me, you know, until you dig a hole, you plant a tree, you water it, and you make it survive. You haven't done a thing. You're just talking. So to make sure that we finish this podcast with not just talking, but actually doing something, I'm going to ask you, so now what? What do we do next, collectively, individually? Send us away with something to roll our sleeves up with.
Ask questions. And ask questions about what we are doing for climate, what we are doing for the environment, and how fast. So that's my takeaway, or I want to give away that as a catalyst for collective action.
Thank you. What about you, Sonchao?
To connect with the quote you just mentioned, I think is to plant a seed of how to be rather than what to do, and to find that our own sense of renewable energy and our own sense of resilience when we're approaching this work, and to plant that seed for the future imagination and to start acting now, because what we're experiencing now is the fruit of the past, but what we can have in the future is the fruits of the seed we're planting right now.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much, Sonchao. And Victoria?
Connect to local action. Every place has a climate story, which means every place has a climate plan. In your city, your village, your law firm, your school, everyone should be taking climate action. And if you don't yet have a seat at that table, pull up a chair.
So that's wonderful. Be curious, connect to yourself, and connect to your local environment. Well, that's it for this episode, and huge thanks to my guests today. National Geographic Explorer and Executive Director of the Preserving Legacies Initiative, Victoria Herrmann. Sonchao Yao, Founder and Chief Explorer at wildbound.earth. and Ramit Debnath, inaugural Cambridge Zero Fellow and Assistant Professor at the University of Cambridge. It's been such an injection of hope and wonder to talk to you all today. My thanks too to producers Mandy Garner from Gates Cambridge and Nick Saffel from the Central Communications Office at the University of Cambridge. And of course, thanks to all of you for listening. We're brand new, so do let us know what you think. I'm Catherine Galloway, and this was So Now What with Gates Cambridge. Join us again next time for another wicked problem dissected by those determined to do something about it.